Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I travel to sit face-to-face with my guests in their own homes to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Hoagy Carmichael is a producer, director, author, and bamboo rod builder. Growing up as the son of one of America's most cherished songwriters, Hoagy is no stranger to the pressures of passing on legacies. In 1968, he met bamboo rod builder Edmund Everett Garrison, where he would eventually chronicle the work of one of fly fishing's greats. You can find this video in the members section of anchoredoutdoors.com. Sign up today and get your first month free. You can cancel at any time. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by Norvice. From their original 1970s prototype to their new legacy stainless steel vise, Norvice has been committed to one thing: efficiency. The company's long-standing slogan, "Tie better, flies faster," truly encompasses what the Norvice fly tying system does. The good folks at Norvice believe you deserve to tie your flies consistently and in less time because of the ease and benefits engineered into this outstanding tying system. For more information, visit norvice.com, that's www.nor-vice.com, and check them out on YouTube to see how you can maximize your tying time by relying on the functions and benefits of the tested and true Norvice. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay.
Oh, good. Is it quiet, or I'm not that experienced with phone interviews?
No, you're perfect. Yeah.
Perfect. I was so embarrassed and horrified when I came to see you in New York and realized we got halfway through our episode and my mic wasn't plugged in. In my top three least favorite moments of having this podcast to date.
Well, stuff happens.
It does. I am rolling. So let me just set the stage for my listener.
Yeah.
I don't do any of these interviews over the phone because I believe that if you're going to hear someone's story, you need to look them in the eye. But it's so hard for me to get to New York, and neither of us are getting any younger, and you've had these life changes, you know, and I just thought to myself, you know what, damn it, I've got to put my pride aside, and I can still see your office in my head, and I can still smell Manhattan, and I can still see your face, so I feel like I'm still there.
Well, that's nice of you to say that. I'm actually in North Carolina right now, producing this musical using my father's music. And we have two shows today, in fact. So not until 2:00 my time is the first one. So this is perfect for me. You know, if you can understand me, I'm ready.
Yep, I've got you. So the biggest change is obviously you've had you've had a change in health. You sound a lot different than when I had spoken to you before, but I still can hear, you know, your timbre and your voice, and I know that it's you, but Hoagie, what happened?
Well, I started to have a lisp back in August. Went to the doctor when I came back from salmon fishing on the Cascapedia, and they said, and they went and did a biopsy, and it was cancer of the tongue down at the base of my tongue. So I went in for radiation, 35 of them, and chemo, and then they did a biopsy, and the cancer's gone. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, my stomach started, and I'm not going to go into details, but I was starting to bleed from my stomach. It's called upper GI bleed. And they went in there and did a biopsy, and damned if I didn't have a form of cancer in my stomach.
Oh, my goodness.
So back in for radiation. And radiation, you don't feel it, you can't touch it, you can't see it. But man, oh man, it is no joke. And so I've basically felt semi-horrible since December. It's only in the last, I mean, I've been in the hospital emergency 4 times since, you know, this year. And 17 packs of blood and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, my wife has saved my backside. She's just been there every second for me, you know. And I lost 55 pounds, but I was strong enough to get through it. And now I do tongue exercises. My stomach is fine. There's no cancer there anymore. And it's just getting my use of my tongue back the way it was. And that's a long process. So that, in a nutshell, is what I've gone through. It's been hell, but I'm alive and enjoying myself.
I just can't even imagine, especially because you're so well-spoken, and I just can't even imagine having to learn speaking over again.
Well, that's basically eating, swallowing.
Yeah.
And managing saliva. Managing saliva is a big one. Your tongue is not just there to stick it out at people. It's there for 3 or 4 reasons that are crucial. And mine is compromised on the left side. But it's improving. 8-10 weeks ago, you probably could not have understood me. So
let's start the scene with where you were born and raised, and if you're willing to tell me when you were born, that would be nice as well.
You ask me the questions, I'll tell you no lies.
Okay, Hoagie, how old are you?
I am 81. I was born 1938 in Los Angeles.
Into a show family, I assume?
Yes. My father was working at Paramount and writing songs. And he was yet to make his first movie. But, yeah, we were in L.A., went back to New York for a year or so, and then Los Angeles until I was almost 23. And then I moved to New York.
Okay, now it's been almost 3 years since I came to see you. I remember because I was in my first.
Is it really?
Yeah, I was in my first trimester. Remember, I was pregnant and so tired.
Yep, I do.
I can time it all around that. And I don't remember everything, but I do remember you saying something about being in a studio when you were growing up.
Well, yes. My father made 11 films and often wrote the music for the films. And we were in those studios often as children, being babysit by people like Victor Mature and all sorts of other people. So, yeah, I don't want to say I grew up in Hollywood studios, but it was very common for us to sit around and watch Janet perform, which is that and many other things is so rare. And I got to tell you, April, I've been sick for a while this year, and I thought fortunate I have been in my life to not be one of those children in Yemen or Syria or Germany or Japan. I mean, you just, why me? And to be healthy and it's been, but here I am, 81 years old and pretty healthy right now.
And still working, apparently.
Oh, boy. You bet. I'm producing a musical. I'm producing a musical using my father's music called Stardust Road. And we're in North Carolina, the marvelous little theater. We have two shows today. So I'm happy.
Well, let's jump right into your fishing. Did you grow up fishing?
No. My father had no interest in fishing. I was able to talk him into taking me to the Sierra Nevada mountains once. Yeah, I mean, we sat the boat and threw stuff out there. I don't remember catching anything, although there was a restaurant out in San Fernando Valley that had a big pond, and you could put a dough ball on a hook, and you could catch a foot of trout about 10 inches long, on essentially every cast. And then you paid for the trout and ate it. And I came back with, you know, 10 or 12 of them. You're supposed to come back with two. And I thought, ooh, this is... No, it was a woman. It was a woman that introduced me to fishing, fly fishing, in 1967.
Oh, do tell, do tell.
We were going to Expo 67 up in Canada, and she said, let's stop in Vermont on the way down and try it. And, oh, my God, was I hooked. I was a golfer. I was actually rather good, very good amateur golfer. And there was so much to learn in fly fishing. I caught one fish on the Baton Kill, but I realized I knew nothing about flies and hooks and rods and reels and entomology and nothing. And I loved the solace of it, the being out in the river. Oh, I don't want to say zen, but believe me, I did not think about work or golf or anything. And it was transformative for me. And the next year, I put my clubs away, my golf clubs away. At the end of the year, the gal left me for another fellow. And I thought, this is for me. And it's been for me, really, ever since. I took golf up again 4 or 5 years ago for the fun of it. But no, this sport has never let me down. I went 16 days on the Grand Cascapedia without getting a pull of a salmon, and still I was ready on the 17th day to go fishing. So I love this sport. I can't not. And this year I've been unable to throw a fly at anything. So this is the first pause year for me since 1967.
So you would have been 30 when you started fly fishing then? Around 30?
Yeah, that's right. I was a stockbroker, and I hated it. Hated it. Oh, my God, did I just like it. But it was a way that I could play golf and competitive golf and stay in the art. And I quit that as well. And went up to Boston and worked for a public television station and began to learn about fly fishing and bought my first fiberglass rod and a Fluger reel. So, you know.
Were you obsessed with fishing?
Semi, I guess so. I knew I had an enormous amount to understand and read about, and I had a mentor who guided me, an angling mentor, and I was very fortunate to be among people who were members of clubs and knew where to go and all that. And I was a young kid tailing along with people who knew a lot more than I did and who were willing to take me in and basically teach the sport to me.
I mean, you'd already started. I'm assuming you met your mentor after you'd started. But who was he?
Well, he's nobody that anybody's ever heard of. His name was Dudley Soper. He was a maker of fiberglass rods. He was as great a dry fly fisherman as ever lived, I promise you. And, oh my God, was he great. And Dudley was a, you know, had a little shop outside of Albany, New York. Had nothing. He barely could get enough money to pull a car together. But I loved him, and I made a film about Everett Garrison and fly rod making. And Dudley is the man that he goes fishing with on the Devastating River in the film. So you've seen that.
Oh, my goodness. See, I'm so happy I asked about this mentor, even though he may not have a recognizable name, because all of these pieces come together, though. So before you'd even met Mr. Garrison, you already had a particular fondness for rod builders and for shops.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, okay.
I never had a bamboo rod in my hand, but I knew that they existed. And Dudley had one, which I finally got to see. It was an Orvis rod. Uh-huh. And I was fascinated by the fact that these were six pieces glued together. How did he do that? And then when I met Mr. Garrison, I was out on the lawn at this fabulous fishing club called Tuscarora. And I had my Dudley Soper orange fiberglass rod and my Fluger medalist wheel, and oh boy, did I feel like the king of the mountain. And I looked around, and there was this older man and three or four of the members, and they all had these beautiful looking bamboo rods. Oh, and I knew enough to, you know, wind my line in and quietly put my fiberglass rod away and walk over to see what the hubbub was about. And that turned my head forever. Because I met Mr. Garrison, and I saw those rods, and I cast one, and I said, okay, this is it.
Can you please explain to my listener who Mr. Garrison was?
Yes. Mr. Garrison was a mechanical engineer. He learned to make fly rods when he was about 30, 35. Had his own tapers, which he figured out with slide rules and pen and pencil. And he started to make hand-planed rods, not machine-made rods, and had a very interesting clientele. He lived in Yonkers, New York, not far from New York City. And his rods, he made about 600 rods. And his rods became, along with Jim Payne and Leonard and F.E. Thomas and several others, became the standard, the gold standard. I'm not ever going to say that they were the greatest rods made. I have often said Jim Payne made was the greatest rod builder, but Everett Garrison made rods that were unparalleled, in my estimation. But the way he made the rods, with his right hand and his left hand, no machines. Well, he had a lathe to fit the ferrules and a couple of, you know, drill press, but it was all handwork. And before he died, he taught me much about the craft. And when he died, I bought the tools, and he got me started.
You're definitely understated, because it couldn't have been easy to get in with him. I remember watching the video and thinking to myself, that man, it would take so long to get him to trust somebody to bring them in like that. He just looks so ornery and so shut down.
Well, that's very perceptive of you, because that's true. Mr. Garrison didn't need a protege. And Mr. Garrison, he wasn't the kind of guy who would close his shop door. but, you know, he was a small maker compared to pain letters, et cetera. And you had to travel to see him. I did. But I think what he liked about me is that I did travel. I was producing a show called Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and, well, executive director, et cetera. And Everett liked the fact that I wanted to mark things down. I wanted to other people to understand what he was doing. It was not about me being another Rod Baker, taking the craft at that point. And so he let me in. And I took him fishing a couple of times. And, you know, there comes a time in people's lives where they often open the door for somebody to come in and continue the work that one does. And maybe I showed up at the right time. I don't know. But, you know, he knew I loved him, and he knew I was interested in the craft, and that was enough, I think.
Coming up, Hoagie and I continue our conversation. Again, a special thank you to Norvice for making this episode possible. The good folks at Norvice believe that you deserve to expect consistency and efficiency out of your tying system. When tying on the Norvice, you will quickly see the benefits of tying flies while physically spinning the vise. This is a remarkable feature that I strongly recommend watching on the Norvice YouTube channel. There are a lot of great rotary vises on the market, but only the Norvice spins the hook. It's for this reason that it's been said that Norvice is the most innovative fly tying system on the market. Never again do you have to wind slack thread onto your bobbin spool. The Norvice Auto Bobbin does the work for you. For more information, visit www.norvice.com. That's nor-vice.com. And check them out on YouTube to see how you can maximize your tying time by relying on the functions and benefits of the tested and true Norvice. Garrison's tapers were still really renowned. What was so special about them?
That's really hard to explain, but he understood there was almost nothing empirical about Everett's tapers. They were all on paper. He figured out load factors, impact factors, stress on bamboo, length versus line weight, all that, which Jim Payne blundered all that. They didn't have that background, taking nothing away from any of those people.
Yeah.
And Everett, when he got his formula for a rod length and a line weight on a piece of paper, he stuck with it. And there is a different feeling to one of Mr. Garrison's rods than a Jim Payne rod, 8-footer, two-piece. They feel very different. Some like them, like Everett's taper is better, some don't. And that's fine. But his were mechanically, from an engineer's standpoint, his rods were very different in terms of how the tapers were put together. Jim Payne and Everett were very good friends, but how they went about it was very different.
Can you explain to people listening just how, this is a loaded question, pardon the pun, but can you explain the basic construction of a bamboo rod, how it's spliced and glued together to create a...
Sure. Well, it's a piece of bamboo that grows in China. It's split into six pieces. Let's say we're making a tip section. And then it has to be triangulated, and that's done with either a machine or by hand in a groove, and you end up with an equilateral triangle, six of them, that are, when you bunch them together, they become a hexagon, and a hexagon of six pieces of something, and they're glued together and tapered, or they're tapered first, and then glued taken off, and the six pieces are sanded, and then you put the guides on and the ferrules on and the top guide, and I mean, in a very quick minute and a half, that's what it is. It's a long piece, tapered, that is six pieces that are nested together and glued, and hopefully will never come apart.
So did he only do
six? Does that help?
That's beautiful. It's beautiful. Thank you. Did he only do six sides? Did he ever do five?
He did. No. Never. He tried it once. I shouldn't say never. And there's a stronger side to a fight. Mr. Garrison liked the idea that from any angle, side, even underhand, overhand, left side, right side, you got the same six-piece feeling.
I thought I heard you say Mr. Rogers, that you did the show Mr. Rogers.
I did.
Is that, am I thinking the children's show, Mr. Rogers?
Yeah.
Like, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, a beautiful day in the
neighborhood. A beautiful day for a neighbor. Won't you be mine? Won't you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor?
Cry, that was you? Mm-hmm. You did that?
Well, I worked on it. Yeah, you bet. He was actually my minister for my first marriage. And a very good friend. And he's having a marvelous renaissance, you know. There's a postage stamp with him, and Tom Hanks is doing a movie. It'll be out in November.
Oh.
And there's been a documentary. Yeah, Fred Rogers.
Oh, my goodness. I grew up on that. I mean, that was the show.
Yeah.
I actually played it for my daughter.
Yeah.
So since I've seen you, I've had a daughter. And
right.
And she loves it. That is amazing. Why didn't you make a fishing video about yourself?
Why would I? I guess. I mean, I leave that to somebody else if that's important. I mean, I finished one not too long ago about sparse gray hackle, about a 35, 40 minute film. I had filmed them in the 80s and finally decided to put it together 2 years ago. And I'm more interested, I think, in other people other people's endeavors, maybe than I can't answer that question, I guess.
Yeah, I was just always surprised that you didn't end up in front of the camera, because you could have.
Well, maybe I will.
Okay, I'd just like to pick your brain a little bit more about that video, because it really was a very special video for me. I felt like I was being invited into a very private time in history that's just... it actually saddens me that things get lost and forgotten so fast. I'd like to make that video be curriculum for people getting into fly fishing. I think that everyone should watch it.
That's exactly why I made it. You hit it. Because I knew he was getting on. He was in his late 70s. And I wanted to, as I said earlier, mark it down. I wanted this man's work not to be lost. And that's not selfish. That is just me... I think, if I may say so, recognizing that if I let this go much longer, nobody would ever see it or learn from it. So that's why I did it. Period.
Well, it sounds really similar with your purchase of the shop as well. I mean, he was going to hand that, I'm assuming that shop would have been handed down to you. Is that a safe assumption?
Oh, yes.
But you chose to purchase it?
Yeah, well, it's about all the money I had, actually. But yes, for about $6,000, I bought everything and moved it. Well, I made some lots in that basement, but then moved it, yeah.
And where is it now?
And you must understand that for me, I didn't know what I needed to know when Mrs. Harrison died, but I left everything exactly where it was when he died. And I began to see the causal relationship between that piece of metal there and that piece of wood there, if you understand me, and that the two were, that one marries with that one, and I understand now how, you know, all that. Well, it's at the shop. I gave it to the Catskill Museum, Catskill Fly Fishing Center, and it's the sort of centerpiece of their rod-making area. And that's where it belongs. Harrison was a Catskill rod-maker, essentially. And people have learned a lot and seem to enjoy the experience of just standing in front of the bench, let alone touching anything. So, you know, with the book and the film and everything, I gave everything to them. There's education standing lying right there if one wants to take advantage of it.
You went on to write more books after that. I'm not sure how many, though. How many books have you written about fly fishing?
Five.
Can you go ahead and just... Yeah, I know Atlantic Salmon is an overlaying theme. What else have you written about?
Well, I wrote a two-volume set about the Grand Cascapedia River in Canada, Salmon River. And it's really more than just about the river. If I may say so, it sits in the cradle of history about the sport. And then in between Volume 1 and Volume 2, I wrote a book called 8 by Carmichael. And there's some stories in there, but the real contribution, if again I may say so, is a long piece about Jim Payne. I had thought for years, why is nobody doing this? I mean, this man was almost in a class by himself. So I took a rest, a pause, from Cascapedia 1 and 2, and wrote this 60-some-odd pages about Jim Payne, and had photographs and found photographs, and tried to explain to people what he meant to the craft and to the sport. And there's some other stories, time with Chauncey Lively and the great Vince Marinaro and some things like that. But if there is a contribution, it would be the Jim Payne book. And then what I consider to be a delicious little book called Sidecast, which has a piece in there about why women seem to catch more salmon than men. Yeah. And some other things. There's quite a bit about women in the sport. A piece about the Alta, the great Alta River, which I've been to twice in Norway, caught fish there. And really, I put myself on a short limb, but helped to introduce dry fly fishing to the Alta River and large salmon. But the guides, when I put a dry fly on, with my 14-footer, they frowned. I mean, visibly frowned. And once I caught some fish with dry flies, they wanted my dry flies to try.
Of course.
And, you couldn't buy a dry fly in the local shop.
No, they frown at all of the other of the non-resident flies. I remember the first time I went to Norway, they looked at, I think, every single fly in my box and told me it was garbage.
Yeah.
And those flies went on to catch fish. I don't know if it's just
tradition
or... yeah.
Very much so.
Hoagie, were you dead drifting dry flies or were you waking them?
Well, there's a thing we do in the Grand Cascapedia, let me see if I can remember what it's called. You throw the fly over the fish He doesn't take dead lift. He doesn't take him. And then you pull it back over him and above him 8 to 10 feet and let it drift again. And they'll move for it. You can't catch a fish on the dry fly unless you present it. And one of the reasons that they hadn't caught fish on dry flies is because they didn't use them. And that's not quite true, because I'm sure people have used them. I mean, I'm not putting myself as a pioneer here, but I was with some wizened, wonderful guys, and it was an eye-opener for them, at least, and what brought me a lot of enjoyment knowing that. I mean, Lee Wolf told me years in New York, gosh, 1980 maybe, that the water temperature is 45 degrees or more. An Atlantic salmon will take a dry fly. I think Lee was right.
Yeah, they used to put a lot of emphasis on water temperature. And I feel like it's something that's kind of been forgotten. But if you read all the old history books, the temperature was a major part or a major player in their decision making.
Yeah. I mean, I was on the Lerdo one time where the water never reached 41 degrees. And it was July. And we caught nothing. You know, if the water gets to be 75 or 8, you're probably going to catch nothing. It's that 55-degree zone that you want, and, you know, give or take. And, nobody knows why a salmon takes a fly anyway. And don't you start to tell me, because you don't know. I don't know. I know. So why wouldn't they roll to a dry fly or a wet fly or a tiny? You know, 2 years ago, we were using size 22 and 24 hitched tooth flies, which are, you know, the size of your little pinky fingernail. And we caught a fish 28 pounds doing that. With a single hook. One landed, several lost, of course, but why do they take it? Why can they see it? Is that anything they've ever eaten, even back, you know, in Greenland or wherever they were? One doesn't know.
No, and we can pretend to know all we want. But you said something interesting.
Isn't that wonderful that we don't know?
Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. It definitely keeps me enthusiastic.
Yes. Let me try this one. Bang! Oh, my God, it worked.
But then it just consumes your thoughts all day, and you get this false confidence, and then it doesn't work again for 10 years.
That's right. Well, that's right. But so be it. That's okay with me.
What's the story behind women having more luck? Because you're right, a lot of the record Atlantic salmon have been caught by female anglers.
Well, there is this thing, whether you want to believe the science behind it or not,
pheromones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And,
now, funny, I have to cut you off, Hoagie, because something very funny happened today. I got a package in the mail addressed to my husband's cousin. And I said, I didn't open it because it's not my mail. And I asked Charles what it is. And he said that there are these pheromones for his cousin that he can't get in Canada. And we now have to ship them from here. Apparently, they're selling these pheromones for men to help pick up women.
I've never heard of that. That's interesting.
I'm staring at the package right now. I'm so tempted to open it, but it's illegal, so I won't. But I'm fascinated by these pheromones. Yeah. But anyway, continue.
Well,
do tell about pheromones.
Pheromones are a hormone that only women have. And there's been a fair amount of science on this. I, in fact, on the altar, asked the waitress in our little camp if she would put two And she did.
Can she just put them in her armpits or something? Does it need to be her?
No. Well, she walked around with them in there for a while, and then I promptly went out and caught a 28 or 26 pound salmon. And working very hard, I actually had her put the fly on the leader and showed her how, and then sucked it up by putting the hook in a tree, you know, like that. So I wouldn't touch it. You can believe it. You cannot believe it. That's okay. But if one were to read not just my book, but other pieces of literature, you would see that there there's a cadre of people in science that believe this can help. Stan Bogdan told me three times. He said, "I never go fishing with a woman because she usually outfishes me."
And I can't dispute it because, you know, I've got some decent fish.
Yes, you have.
I do hear that there are some manufacturers who are putting pheromones into their baits and into their chemicals. But how do you collect pheromones? I don't understand how that works. Like, do you just come scrape DNA off of me? It's fascinating.
I have no idea and really no interest. I'll take my chances. There is something called presentation. And presentation, in my mind, outranks pheromones.
Yeah,
I agree.
You have
to put the fly in front of the salmon correctly, for the most part. The process I was talking about earlier, where you put the fly in and then pull it back, and it's called fast and loose.
So, okay.
Fast and loose.
Fast and loose. Is that just how you're retrieving it? Why is it called fast and loose?
Well, because you loose, meaning you dead-drift it, and then you pull it up, and then dead-drift it again, and they'll take it. They will take it as you're essentially dragging it, not over them, but very near them. So you pull it up, but mostly they take it because they see it again. And they get a couple of cracks at it in a very short amount of time. That's what I believe, and who cares whether it's true or not, fact or not. You know?
So what's your involvement these days, Hoagie, with fishing? I know this last year has been really hard, but in general, do you consider yourself part of the fly fishing, quote unquote, industry?
Not now. I mean, quite how to say this, but I've worked pretty hard through my books and through countless demonstrations of rod building. I've probably done 150 of them or something like that, showing the film and showing people. And as somebody who was always interested in passing on information, I don't know why, but a lot of rod makers, you probably know this, I'm not going to mention names, but if you knocked on their door, they would not let you in. They were afraid to pass information along. I guess that's the word for it. And I've never seen any reasons for that. So, I'm among that group of people who were interested in the future generations knowing as much as they could about the sport. This sport doesn't belong to me. It belongs to all of us. And thank God we have this sport, because to my way of thinking, there's essentially nothing like it. I mean, my golfing career was, I got down to the point where I could play Well, I was a member of a place called Shinnecock out in Long Island where they had the Open 2 years ago. I was a one handicap club champion and all that. And once I discovered fly fishing, it just was like a wave that went over my golfing life and never to be seen again. And I had this new arena of experiences, books, people to meet, and to understand things. And people help me understand the why not be a part of the group that helps younger generations. And I think some of us have accomplished that.
Does it sadden you to know that there are so many young people coming into fly fishing today who just have no idea about the history? And it's not even their fault in a lot of ways. They don't read as much. It's just being lost. It's like this big barrier
hit the nail right on the head, because people want information in 9 seconds. They have access to their phones and computers, but they don't seem to have the time to read books the way we did. And, the collection of books that come onto the market today are worth about a third of what these books were worth 25, 35 years ago. There's a small group of people interested in collecting and reading. And I think that is a shame, but, it's the way of the world. Your word is good, saddened by that. But, what can I do? What can we do?
Hoagy, if you could be remembered for anything in this sport, what would it be?
Certainly the Bamboo Rod book was a contribution that at the time I had no idea would spark as many people as it has. So, my other four books have a relevance, if I may say that without question. No, I can say that. But the Bamboo book is in its 8th printing and, something like 25,000-30,000 copies. And that is meaningful. And remembers. I made some nice rods. I wrote about them. I tried to help other people understand it. And I guess that's where I'll be paid, if ever.
I think you're just all class. Thank you.
Very welcome.
Is there something about something in your career that I've missed here in this very brief timeline that you wanted to add? Or just your life in general that I've missed that you wanted to add?
Well, I have been very lucky, I can say this, in meeting some of the, quote, giants of the sport. And they have let me in. And if you let a person in, you run the risk of allowing that person to disseminate and pass information on. And that is a treasure. And I have been one of those people. Let me just say for a minute that this is hard to say, but my name, I've known this all my life. My name has been unwittingly a key, a door opener. I don't like that, especially, but I have taken advantage of that fact and allowed those people who would pass over other other folks and wanted me to go fishing with them or go on this trip or work with them or whatever. And I've allowed that to be a way for me to understand some things that other people may not have had the opportunity to understand. And that's been given to me by my father, but if I may say so, I've at times tried to take advantage of that. Yeah. And there we are.
Look, if anything, Hoagie, you're keeping the name alive in, like I said, just the classiest way. So thank you so much for taking the time to share all that with me.
Well, I've enjoyed this, April, and not very often do you get to pat oneself on the back, but it sounds like I have. So there we go. Keep it up. Keep it up. Long after I'm gone, there'll be people like you who also want to pass this sport on to other people. And bravo. Bravo.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.